second Rules Committee. We're only going to work till about 5:15 today, but so we're going to try and get as many bills done as possible. Our track record's been pretty good, but we'll see. Representative Crummel, I know you're here on House Bill 2335. Why don't you come up? Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2335A.
Yes, 2335A?
Yes.
Thank you. Requires the Department of Human Services in cases of child abuse for which an investigation is conducted to provide the child's parent, guardian, or caregiver with an explanation of the investigation and other types of notice.
All right. Representative Crummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummel, House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. 2335 comes to you today. This arose because of an issue that a family that I'm very familiar with in Klamath Falls was having with DHS relative to an accusation that was made against a parent on sexual abuse. And we found that in the situation that there are issues around the length of time that both DHS and law enforcement takes in investigating when a parent, guardian, or caregiver is removed from the home and it's a voluntary removal. Also, there's some issues around due process for parents in this kind of a situation. House Bill 2335, we worked with law enforcement and with the District Attorneys Association as well as Child Protective Services and the courts system in coming up with the language for this to correct the situation. And so it directs DHS to notify the multidisciplinary team for the county in which there's a case, and then at the parent's request, the MDT would then take a look at the case and try to give some kind of input as far as how long they think the investigation should take, and also looking at to see if there are what kind of mechanisms are in place for moving the investigations along so that the families don't have to be kept apart any longer than is absolutely necessary. This bill does not create any new private rights of action, and it also holds the MDT harmless for any lack of action. It was supported on the House side, as I mentioned, by the DA's Association, the Sheriff's Association, and the Oregon Chiefs of Police. We had a work group that met and actually came up with the language that you see in the bill today, and I would recommend and request that the committee move this to the floor without any further amendments and would ask for your support.
Thank you.
I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Crummel. We appreciate you bringing this issue to us.
That's right.
Some familiarity with these cases, having practiced juvenile law for a period of time. The amendment looks to me, and the chair's not going to take the amendment unless the senator gets to us fairly quickly, but my recollection from this particular amendment is that we have already passed a bill out of the Senate addressing the very issues raised in the -A7 amendments. I don't know if you remember dealing with one on the House floor, but...
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the question. Yes, I do remember the amendments, and the A7s, I believe, are very similar to Senate Bill 895. 895 did get bottled up over on the House side and never came to the House floor, and I think that was why the request was made. But I also understand that the DA's Association does have some issues with the -A7 amendments, and that's why we're not requesting that the amendments be put into the bill.
All right. Any other questions for Representative Crummel? All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to close the public hearing temporarily on House Bill 2335. And Senator Walker and Representative Butler, I just want to come up. Which bill number are you here on?
127.
Okay. All right, Ms. Harris, would you tell us a little bit about the bill? And I'm going to open a public hearing on 2070.
Thanks, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 2070 requires certain district school boards to contract with other districts for admission of children with disabilities if the child's individualized education program specifies that the child's needs would be better met by another district.
Senator Walker, Representative Butler, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Vicki Walker, State Senate District 7, I'm going to defer for the moment to Representative Butler because this is his bill, and I'm hitching a ride, and so I will discuss my my hitch in a moment, but I'd like Representative Butler to discuss the underlying bill.
So my first question for you is, have you talked with the sponsor? And you obviously have, so thank you.
Yes, I have, and the sponsor is glad to accommodate me.
Okay. Thank Representative
you.
Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, member of the committee. Tom Butler from House District 60. Recognizing that this is an issue that's very important to Senator Walker and 2070 is an issue which is very important to me, I'm in little position to say, no, you can't do that because the bill is on your side of the building. It is an important piece of legislation for House District 60, and really what the bill does is it does, in fact, provide an opportunity for, in smaller counties, under 50,000 people, for those folks who have IEP programs to be able to work in that school in their community, which best accommodates their needs, even if it's in a different school district. And the money would then follow the student from one school district to the next, again, in these small counties. It is a bill that I worked on for a couple of sessions. The Department of Education had concerns last session about the concept of money following a student, money following a student, but then we've restricted it now in this particular session to discuss only those students with IEPs, and number two, only in counties of under 50,000 people. So that met the minimum requirement, and as I say, we're in a position where we're very anxious to see this legislation pass. And Senator Walker came to me and said that she'd had a bill that was specific to Golden Parachutes, and asked if, because this bill had the correct relating clause, if I would object to this being attached. While I'm anxious about the language of the Golden Parachutes bill, I'm still very anxious to make sure that 2070 get out in some fashion. Thank you.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Dash A3s.
Yes, we have the Dash A3 amendments, which is Senate Bill 766, which passed this chamber earlier this year. I think there were only 8 dissenting votes on that bill. And just to refresh your memory, this is the bill about Golden Parachutes and bringing more accountability and transparency in school administrator contracts. And, in fact, when I had a discussion with Representative Butler about this bill yesterday, he knew exactly what I was talking about, because one of the cases that I had researched and provided information mm-hmm. to my colleagues on the floor of the Senate was a person in his district. So he was very familiar with the concern that I had about these contracts. I thought we did a good job writing the bill. I couldn't get a hearing in the House, so I'm very pleased that Representative Butler is willing to let me hitch a ride, because I think this is good policy.
Great. Questions? I think you're off the hook.
Thank you
very much. I'm going to close the public hearing for the time being on House Bill 2070 and go back up to House Bill 2335. Terry Fennell. Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you. I'm Terry Fennell. I live here in Marion County. I am a foster parent. I currently serve on the I'm the chair of the Oregon Foster Parent Association Legal, the Legislative Committee, also on Marion County's, and I also serve on the National Committee, Legislative Committee. And I am interested in this particular bill with regard to section 1H about providing information to the caregiver, which if it happened to be a foster parent, that they get a clear understanding of what the accusations are. I've been a foster parent for about 20 years, have had over 700 teenagers live in my home. And I've been familiar with many foster parents who have gotten had allegations made that were in a very, very general nature, and as a result, they spent a long time waiting for a solution or an answer or exactly what has happened. The most recent one, it took 8.5 months for resolution to take place. And they did not know what the actual allegations were until they got the final letter 8.5 months after the initial removal of the children.
Mr. Fennell, in terms of you're talking about the investigation took 8.5 months?
In order for them to get an answer about what the allegations were, it took 8.5 months. That's the most recent one.
Okay. And do you know, was a petition for dependency filed during the time period, or was this simply during the, was this before a petition was even filed in that case?
I'm not sure I know the answer to that question.
Okay.
I just know that the children were removed from a foster parent, and it took 8.5 months for them to receive a written explanation from the agency as to what the outcome was going to be.
Okay. Petition's been filed. Okay. Thank you very much. Do you have any questions? You're okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2335? Anybody wishing to testify on the -A7 amendments to 2335? I close the public hearing. Senator Shields will be here at 3:30. At that point, we'll do the work sessions on 2104. Amendments will be ready on 499 for a half an hour. Let's go down to House Bill 2070. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2070? What about the amendments on 2070? No takers? Close the public hearing. Let's go to House Bill 2202. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2202. Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, House Bill 2202A directs the State Commission on Children and Families to work with certain state agencies and advisory committees to develop state policy regarding runaway and homeless youth and their families.
Ms. Lassiter. Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for the information this afternoon. I think it's fair to say we'd appreciate if you'd summarize the written testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown and members of the committee. My name is Jean Lassiter, and I work here in Marion County in the human services field. And I'm also a member of the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition. And what I've provided you is, in your written testimony, is an overview of a report that was formulated over the process over 1.5 years by a coalition of individuals and agencies that are listed in the back of the report. You also have some talking points in favor of House Bill 2202, as well as letters in support of the bill from the Oregon Alliance of Children's Advocates, the Coalition of Advocates for Equal Access for Girls, the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and the Marion County Children and Families Commission. And I know that you want this to be brief, and so in summary, what I'll say is that that overview it represents a body of work that actually was composed and compiled through a lot of effort on the part of a lot of people to take a look at the issue of runaway and homeless youth in the state of Oregon and to really, at least at first blush, evaluate the status of those young people, the systems that they do or don't get into and come up against, what some of the issues that are faced by communities with regard to those young people and so on. We involved parents. We conducted a survey with the Children and Families Commissions and got responses from them. We used the one-night shelter counts from HUD. And what we came up with to continue our advocacy for these young people, who, by the way, number in the 20, 20,000s of young people and are really, in my estimation, a bellwether group of how well we're doing with our kids. These young people have not been served well by the state, at least in recent time, and I think that what we came up with is in front of you in the form of House Bill 2202, which is to say that we need to address this issue and we need to carry forth the work that's been done initially and find a better way to serve these young people and their families. The House Bill 2202 is, in my mind, a sound legislation, piece of legislation that designates the Oregon Commission on Children and Families as the facilitator of a very important process, and it enables us to empower communities to provide information to the state, and it enables us to bring multiple agencies together to address an issue that is long overdue in addressing.
Thank you, Ms. Lasseter. I work with the Citizens Crime Commission and Juvenile Rights Project on a bill, Senate Bill 1034. The other piece during the interim, and the other piece of that was exploring ways that for the youth that are in foster care, the dollars can follow the youth.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope, I know that there are a number of work groups out there. I would hope through this task force we could explore dollars following the homeless youth so that they can get the services they need when they blow out of foster care. So just want to put that on your radar screen as well. Appreciate your hard work.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay. Senator Ringo.
I just had a question about the staff measure summary says there's no fiscal impact, and I was just...
That's right.
Doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
There is one error in one report, but that's not
that well. Thank you. And
you are welcome.
I always like to know how things are accomplished without a fiscal.
Mm-hmm. I'm
going to help her out, but I know through my work, Senator Ringo, on the Oregon Law Commission Juvenile Code Rewrite, is that both DHS and the Law and the Children and Families Commissions have ad hoc groups meeting daily, minute by the minute on these issues, and I think this is a coordination of those efforts that are already taking place.
Well, Madam Chair, I expected an answer like that.
Oh.
Thank you. But so
did you want her to answer your question?
No, your answer was fine, but then the follow-up, Madam Chair, is that does that mean that all this could be happening anyway since the agencies apparently have the resources currently to do this?
Senator Ringo, Chair Brown, I would defer part of the answer and probably your most significant answer to Mickey Lansing, who's in the back of the room. But what I can say on my behalf and the behalf of the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition, that as I understand it, this bill is an effort and intentionality, and is intended to be accomplished only under the current budgetary constraints of the commission. And so basically it provides an avenue for a conversation and intentionality with no new dollars attached to it.
Is everything she just said true?
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, yes, that is true.
Thank you.
To the extent, for the record, my name's Mickey Lansing, Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. To the extent possible with existing resources and structures, we are going to intentionally address this issue.
Okay.
And we will report back to you.
Thank you. Well, Madam Chair, I mean, if it helps you in any way solve this problem, then I am an enthusiastic yes. I just like to ask questions about where people will get resources from when we're not giving them any money.
Thank you. And Ms. Lansing, my only caveat would be I appreciate the fact that you're going to do a report. I would really, to the extent that you can within given resources, focus on outcomes of specific programs if you have identified any that are working. Anything positive that we can add on to build from would be extremely helpful next session as we tackle this issue. So,
thank you, Chair Brown.
Thank
we
you.
Will.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
No questions? All right. No, public hearing on House Bill 3029. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3029A transfers the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee from the Oregon Justice Commission to the State Commission on Children and Families.
All right. Ms. Lansing, Ms. Eklund, Mr. Schneider, and is Representative Wisnett in the room? I bet he's up in a meeting.
He's in his office.
Great. Okay. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair Brown, for the record, my name is Mickey Lansing, Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. The Governor's Office approached the Commission on Children and Families and the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, hoping to coordinate better prevention funds in the state. Since juvenile crime preventions are, in fact, for those populations that we want to make sure don't penetrate further into the juvenile justice system, and the Commission on Children and Families is about prevention, it made sense, both fiscally and structurally, to move the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee to the commission. So, House Bill 3025 does just that. Through Partners for Children and Families, which was the result of Senate Bill 555, we already work very closely with the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, the Department of Education, the Oregon Youth Authority, and the Department of Human Services. And it just seemed to be something that we could do, and we could be coordinating and connecting both the policy work and the allocation of dollars to counties where they make individual decisions about their particular needs.
Okay. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Becky Eklund. I'm the Juvenile Crime Prevention Coordinator with the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. I want to support all the things Mickey said, and I think in addition, the governor's recommendation to move the juvenile crime prevention program not only coordinates better with the other prevention efforts, but it also allows the Criminal Justice Commission to focus more directly on their primary purpose, which is planning for the criminal justice system as a whole.
Thank you. Mr. Snyder.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. We also support House Bill 3029. It provides for an appropriate mechanism for coordination of similar functions.
All right. We're all on board. Any questions for this panel? When Representative Wisnett comes back, we'll make sure he gets on the record. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, I do have one question. Why was an emergency clause added? Is added in the House?
Madam Chair, an emergency clause was added because we wanted, at the end of the fiscal year, we wanted to be able to transfer employees and the functions as smoothly as possible and as quickly as possible. And we have been working on those functions in preparation of.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's move on to Senate Bill 1068, which creates the crime of violating a lease. Unless anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3029. Close public hearing. House Bill 3029. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1068. Oh, good. Lots of bodies. All right. Ms. Skinner. Ms. Kunkel. And Ms. Hebb. Hi. Good to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Gina Skinner. I'm a Deputy District Attorney, and I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney Association. I'm a Deputy District Attorney in Washington County. I have been prosecuting as a Deputy District Attorney for 8 years now, and I have been specializing in the prosecution of domestic violence during that entire time. Senate Bill 1068 is a very important bill to the association because this has become a major problem in the prosecution of domestic violence. Currently, the law requires that when a defendant is arrested for a crime of domestic violence, that when they are released from jail, and the far majority of defendants of domestic violence crimes are in fact released from jail, that a release agreement will be put in effect that will prohibit them from having contact with their victim. That currently is the law. The problem that we're having is enforcing this court order. What happens is that currently the law is not very specific about the authority that the police officers have to enforce this order. Currently, under the law, under 133.310, the police, if they have probable cause to feel that a crime has been committed, whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony or an unclassified offense, that they have the authority to arrest. There is nothing in the law that gives them the authority to arrest if there is a contempt of court. But specifically under subsection 6 of that statute, it does mandate that they do arrest if a defendant is in violation of the no contact provision of a release agreement on a domestic violence crime, but only specifically if the underlying offense is either an assault, menacing, or a sex case. The officer at the scene know that the majority of these release agreement violations are going to occur on weekends, at night, at times where a judge or a district attorney is not available to be able to provide this information. They only know that there's a valid release order out there and the condition prohibits the defendant from having contact with the victim. They don't know what the underlying charge is. So police officers are confused. They don't know how to respond in that situation. And so many times I've been teaching at the police academy for 4 years now, teaching domestic violence crimes. And what I hear from the police officers is they're being told from their supervisors that if they're not sure, then they should err on the side of not arresting because there's no other authority that gives them allows them to arrest. And so they just submit a police report to the court, hoping that in the future a court would issue a warrant for that person's arrest. That doesn't help the victim who currently has the suspect in their home that has been violent towards them in the past. The concern is that these cases are set when there's a release agreement that is out there set prohibiting the defendant from having contact with the victim while it's pending trial. The concern is that the defendants will use every means available to them to prevent the victim from coming to court, whether coming to court personally or from intimidating them or threatening them in any manner so that their testimony will not be provided against the suspect. And this is the concern we have about the suspects having contacts with the victim. So there needs to be some clear provisions in the law that gives the police some authority in order to arrest. The domestic violence crimes generally are very, very difficult to prosecute. Victims are often feel threatened and coerced into either not showing up or to minimize their testimony because they're afraid of their batterers, who oftentimes are their spouses or boyfriends or other domestic partners. Under this provision, it would allow the state to step in and to enforce a court order in an effort to assist those victims to be able to enforce this no contact. Currently, we go ahead and we prosecute all domestic violence crimes if we have the evidence to do so. One of the problems recently, last year, is when Crawford v. Washington came out, that U.S. Supreme Court case required the district attorneys to provide the victim in court if we are going to have any of the statements the victim originally gave to the police at the scene. If we want the officers to testify regarding those statements, the victim has to be present in court. Offenders know that, and offenders are now contacting victims and doing everything they can in an effort to prevent them from coming to court or providing that testimony. We want to be able to hold abusers accountable, and to hold abusers accountable, that would allow us to rehabilitate them by providing, putting them on probation, requiring them to do the treatment that is necessary, or if necessary, having them go to jail or prison because of the violence that they've committed against their domestic partners. Currently, the punishment, if one were to violate a release agreement, is a contempt of court, which is a strange quasi-civil criminal punishment. It doesn't currently fit under the law. is not reflected in their criminal record as far as adding to their criminal history score. When one were to look at a criminal record, they would just see contempt of court, and it wouldn't specifically say anything about a release agreement. It could just as much be that the person cursed at a judge in a courtroom. It would be the same statute that they would be prosecuted against, and we would ask that this be a crime so that that would be reflected and added to their criminal record. Finally, there's a subsection of the crime that this bill that makes it currently under the law. If you assault a domestic victim and get convicted of it, the second time it becomes a felony if you assault the same victim. This would provide that it would be if you assault your domestic partner and then you're out on a release agreement pending trial with a no-contact provision not allowing you to have contact with that victim, and then you assault that person again, that it would also be a felony as well under this bill. It is a limited situation. When it does happen, it's very dangerous, and we want to be able to provide the not only the proper punishment for doing that, but a deterrence so that offenders would not do that, would not come back, would not assault the victim. And often victims are assaulted. It's a very dangerous time for them while the cases are pending, and they're using violence in an effort to try to persuade them not to come to court to testify against them. So we would ask this committee to move forward and pass Senate Bill 1068.
Thank you. Ms. Hebb.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, and I am a civil legal attorney, and the Law Center provides civil legal assistance to low-income Oregonians across the state. Our interest in this bill comes from the fact that we, due to a lack of resources, try to provide services to the neediest Oregonians and victims of domestic violence who have suffered recent violence, who are in fear of further violence, are some of the neediest Oregonians, and we provide services to those people at a prioritized level. And so over the past years, since we have been providing these services, we have come to understand to a greater extent the dynamic of domestic violence and the impact that it has not only on individuals but also on families and communities. And we've come to understand the great importance of the reliability of the public safety system's response when there has been violence. And often we see our clients who have suffered abuse are frequently in a circumstance in which they have a no-contact order that they think protects them. They may choose not to seek a restraining order because they think they have the protection of the no-contact order, and then come to find out further down the line when that order is violated, they do not have the type of protection that they need. And the confusion that Ms. Skinner mentioned has resulted in our experience, we've seen clients who have suffered because their abusers have not been arrested and they have not suffered sanctions for the violations of the release agreements that they've committed. That, as you know, sends a horrible message to the abuser, and the message that gets delivered is that there is not accountability and that there is the ability to manipulate and proceed with the abuse without sanction. So the bill is important to us because we think it sends an important message to batterers about accountability, but it also sends, maybe even more importantly, a message to victims that the system will be there and that there are sanctions that will protect them. So for those reasons, we're supportive of the bill, and thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hebb. Ms. Kunkel.
Senator Brown, Senator Ringo and Atkinson. My name is Jean Kunkel. I'm the manager for the Domestic Violence Trial Team in Marion County. I'm also here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association in support of this bill. I would just concur with everything that Ms. Skinner and Ms. Hebb said and just basically point out that these situations almost always involve batterers who are intentionally disregarding the order of the court to stay away from the victim, and it's just a disregard of the court's order as well as oftentimes further victimizing the victim in these situations.
Okay. All right. Questions for this panel? Appreciate you very much bringing this issue to us. Thank you.
Thanks.
Got somebody else wishing to testify? Ms. Sky and Ms. Miller. Okay, why don't we do Ms. Sky first and then go to Ms. Miller.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we do oppose Senate Bill 1068. There are a lot of other answers besides creating a new crime, answers to the problems that have been discussed here today. As you know, this is already punishable in a number of ways. The first is revocation of the release agreement. The person goes back to jail and they sit there until their case is resolved. If they're out on bail, their bail is forfeited. They lose not only the security that's posted, but the other 90% security that's assigned on the case. It's punishable by contempt proceedings. And, you know, in my county, Multnomah County, contempt proceedings are not so strange. They are routinely and very successfully prosecuted in violation of restraining order cases. There's a whole docket that deals with contempt of court proceedings. People are put on probation in contempt of court proceedings. The maximum penalty is 6 months. And I think that people from the domestic violence victims community would say that that is a success in terms of their ability to prosecute on contempt proceedings. The problem that I'm hearing here, the biggest problem that I'm hearing here is that police are confused about their authority to arrest for violation of a release mm-hmm. agreement, and that is addressed by ORS 133.310. And I would suggest that we amend that statute to make it clear that a police officer has the authority to arrest for violation of a release agreement. And I'd be happy to work with the proponents of this bill on amending that language to make that clearer and to train police officers. One of the reasons that OCDLA is so concerned about this bill is that we often have as much, if not more, contact with the victims in these cases than as the prosecutor's office does. Mm-hmm. And that is because the victims come to us and they say, I want to have contact with this person. And
excuse me, they say they do or don't want to?
They do.
Okay.
And in those cases, it's difficult enough to get it approved by the court. What's important is that oftentimes the contact that has occurred between the offender and the victim is at the victim's initiation. Oftentimes the victim bails the defendant out of jail. And I should have brought a copy of the release agreement with me, but it's fine print that says no contact with the victim. And so sometimes the defendant's not even aware of that condition because they haven't reviewed their release agreement, but more often the victim is not aware of that condition of no contact with the victim because they are not required to be in court when the court imposes that. They're not required to sign the release agreement. They don't know that having contact with the offender, just the simple contact, could subject them or could subject the offender to all the consequences, starting with going back to jail, forfeiting their bail, and now possibly a new crime. And it's because we know that victims initiate this contact so frequently, and I'm not here to go into the reasons why they initiate that contact, but they do. We know they do. Everybody will admit that they do. And because they're not required to follow the no contact order, and they're not even notified of the no contact order frequently, that this places a defendant in extra jeopardy. Now, in the situation where a restraining order has been issued, a victim's gone to a court, they know the consequences of a restraining order violation. They are part of the process. They're initiating the process. They want that process to occur. And so there is less of an issue about victim initiation of contact because they're the people who are asking for the no contact order. In so many of these domestic violence cases, the victim is contacting my office and saying, I want to have contact with the defendant, and how can I do this? And I can't give them legal advice and tell them how to go about doing it.
Ms. Guy, the violation of restraining orders in Multnomah County, are they held in the family law court?
Chair Brown, yes, they are.
Okay.
So, I just want to make sure So I think that actually the answer to this is to clear up the authority to arrest for violation of the no-contact agreement. I don't think that it's difficult. If a police officer knows that there's a release agreement out there that requires no contact with the victim, which it seems to me that if they know there's a release agreement, they know what the crime for which the person is released is. They know if it's a PCS or if it's a domestic violence case. And that being said, you could amend that release agreement statute to require the police to arrest, just as they are required to arrest in other domestic violence offenses and restraining order violations. You know, the other thing that I would bring to the committee's attention is the cost behind this. I think that probably some of these cases, this will be added as another count to an existing charge, but not in all cases. And in my experience, especially in misdemeanor court, this kind of contact is learned at trial, when the victim's on the stand and talks about it, or when they're being or when they're talking with the prosecutor just prior to trial, or they show up at the trial with the defendant, and it can't be added as a charge then. It would be a subsequent charge then. So the cost associated with this,
and that's what Ms. Miller is here to talk about.
And I just wanted to let you know that I do think that it would end up being a subsequent offense. Now, this is currently punishable as contempt, and I can tell you in Multnomah County they don't prosecute them as contempt. I have never seen one of these violations of no contact provisions prosecuted in Multnomah County. It is brought up at sentencings, and sentences are enhanced in light of this. You know, it also is punishable as tampering with a witness, which is a felony. So if there is proof that the person is having contact with the victim for the purpose of altering or getting rid of their testimony at trial, that's a felony charge, and they can prosecute for that as well as contempt proceedings. So we think that this is unnecessary, it's expensive, and that it risks further disempowering the victim. This is not a crime that the victim initiates prosecution of, and the no contact order is not an order that the victim necessarily asks for. I mean, they certainly can, and there are times when they appear and say they don't want to have contact, or they contact the district attorney's office and say I don't want to have contact, but there are equal number of times at least where they do want to have contact and they just don't know how to get around the no contact order. So in those circumstances, we could end up prosecuting people in a way that's unfair to the defendant and may disempower the victim further. So we oppose this bill.
Thank you. Ms. Miller, the cost.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations with the Oregon Judicial Department. The Judicial Department is neutral on the policy decision before you. If you do choose, however, to adopt the bill as written, there is a fiscal impact that does reach the level that we would request a subsequent referral to Ways and Means to Senate Budget. Two sections really create that. Actually, in Ms. Guy's testimony, she was talking about whether or not the new crime of violating a no-contact provision would be done by joining an additional misdemeanor count to the underlying crime. For purposes of our fiscal, we assumed that it would. So we assumed no additional filings with the creation of the new crime. There are judges that are extremely concerned about that assumption, so some may very well agree with Ms. Skye that that would create new crimes. Where the fiscal really comes in is in the increased penalty for assault 4. There are currently 5,366 assault 4 misdemeanors in 2004. We assumed very conservatively 5% of those might be charged under the new statute. If that was the case, you're looking at the difference between a misdemeanor prosecution and a felony prosecution, bringing the fiscal in the neighborhood to $120,000 with that conservative estimate.
Okay.
Be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Where did you get the 5% number?
Madam Chair, it is a very conservative guess, and when I talked to the proponents of the bill, they thought at least one thought that was pretty right on.
Okay.
We thought it was conservative.
Questions for this panel? Senator Ringo?
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. After the proponents discussed the bill, my thinking was, yeah, great idea. We need to do this, because they made a very compelling argument. Then Ms. Skye laid out, I think, very clearly the opposite side. And so now I'm thinking, no, I'm sorry, we can't do this bill. But I would like to hear the proponents respond to her, Madam Chair.
Right. I don't know, Ms. Skinner, whoever you want to bring up.
Gets rebuttal.
Sorry.
Ms. Skinner comes up. I just want folks that are working on this bill to be thinking about if there is truly a 5% problem, which I don't know is big or high, big or low. I just think think we got a problem out there, and if this isn't the solution, then I would really like to see if we can't come up with something and then come back and look at this, if that solution, and then come back, look at the next session. So, anyway, Ms. Guy, ball's in your court.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I do appreciate the opportunity. I am used to having rebuttal, so I do appreciate the opportunity to have that here in this forum.
That's good.
As far as the...
After rebuttal.
No.
As far as...
We don't have time.
The first, one of the points that Ms. Guy made regarding the victims coming forward and wanting to have contact with the suspects, we will agree that that does occur, but there are a couple of reasons for that. One reason is because the offenders have put the victims in such a vulnerable position. Part of domestic violence is about power and control, and that's about basically taking over another person's life and using violence to enforce the rules that they put upon them and not allowing them to have access to money, not allowing them to have access to family and friends, and then using violence in their life and putting them in a position so that when they are violent against them, they are completely dependent upon them, and part of that is the cycle that they're stuck in. Part of what I have heard from victims that have talked to me after a prosecution, when they have thanked me after they have begged me to allow them to have contact, and then they've sent them off to prison, they've thanked me for what they've done. Sometimes, I'm not saying every time, sometimes it's all a show. They're doing it because the suspect is sitting next to them in their house saying, call the prosecutor, go down, I'll drive you to the DA's office so you can drop the charges. I'm not saying that's always the case, but that does happen a significant number of times.
Senator Ringo.
What about the circumstance Ms. Guy raised where sometimes they may not even know of the no-contact order? Does that occur?
That can occur in the sense that these no-contact orders are given out when the suspect is released from the jail. It's something that the suspect does sign as a condition to get out of jail. That our office, our victim assistance office, and I can't speak for every office, contacts victims immediately upon us receiving these charges and explains everything that's going on, including the fact that there is a release agreement and that they're not to have contact, the suspect's not to have contact with them. However, if it does come to our attention that there's a situation where the victim has initiated the contact, you know, we're not going to enforce that, hold that against the suspect unless the suspect has then taken upon themselves to think that, oh, then everything's fine. The suspect is the adult in the situation. They're the one, the prohibition. They're the only ones that are going to be held accountable, but we're not going to, we're not going to intervene in a situation where the victim has, you know, somehow put them at jeopardy without them knowing about it.
Madam Chair.
Sorry.
But I was just getting to the point that in some circumstances, at least, they may not even know of the no contact order, and what the perpetrators may not know because
The perpetrators will. I'm sorry.
I thought Ms. Guy said sometimes it's in fine print. And
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, there is a document that either a release officer or someone from the jail is required to go through with them, and they have to sign like each line of every condition that's on there and sign the bottom and indicate that in fact it's like a contract for them to get out of jail. These are all the conditions. Another condition is that they're required to come back to court on their next court appearance. And there is a crime for them not showing up at their next court appearance, but there's no crime for the other conditions.
But you think that is made explicit to
the state's position that especially on domestic violence cases, that's okay. Very, very, very clear.
Okay, thank you.
You're from Washington County, right?
I am.
Okay.
Ms. Kunkel was just indicating that in theirs, it's in bold print. So that
you're in Marion County. Okay. And Ms. Guy, you're up in Multnomah County, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And on that very, the other issue about the victims wishing to initiate contact, I just sort of made some notes in the written materials that I provided with members, knowing that I would not be able to get into every detail that I wanted to share with the committee. But there is a provision under the law that allows that to be waived. If the victim petitions the court and there's a hearing, a judge can waive the no contact. But we just want a judge to be able to hear it and make sure that the reasons are not because the victim is being coerced to have that condition dropped. But there is a provision in the law that allows it to be dropped under circumstances where that would be appropriate. And so that's not necessarily not allowed. As far as the current punishment or the current remedies, I guess is the best word of what the law is now, this is where we're having so much problem. There is a provision
provision that allows, and I included all this in my written materials, but there's a provision that allows the release agreement to be revoked. The statute for that talks about that the court may issue a warrant for the arrest of the person if they find out that they're violating the release agreement, and then have it revoked. Well, that requires then a court to be involved, some kind of a report to be issued to a court, and so a police officer that's at the scene is not able to remedy a situation when the suspect is there at that moment, and there's going to be many days that go on, and then a warrant has to be issued, and then the warrant has to be served. There's all this time that's going to lapse. In addition to that, if you think about it, I mean, the remedy is that the release agreement is revoked. The jails are full. We're not asking that. We're dealing
except
with
in Multnomah County, where we have several hundred beds filled, which we can't afford to fund.
And we're not asking that these people be held in jail. That's not. When we understand that the jails are full, and we're trying to deal with that reality. The reality is the far majority of people are out on the streets and back in the homes of the victims. And so what happens is that the release agreement gets revoked. The person goes back to jail, and a few hours later, they're released again because it's full. And so then we're back in this cycle. And as Ms. Head was indicating, there's no accountability. I mean, the offenders know that nothing is going to happen to them. What their goal is to get the charges against them dropped, and they will do anything in any way that they can. And the thing between them and getting charges dropped is influencing the victim and their testimony. I mean, because the bottom line is under Crawford v. Washington, if the state cannot produce the victim at court, we were going to have to drop the charges. And they know that, and they've been told that, and that's what they're seeking to do.
Madam Chair?
Sarah Ringo.
One of the things Ms. Guy raised is right now there's the ability to obtain a contempt order, and a contempt could be punishable by up to 6 months.
That's correct. Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, the problem that we're having with contempt is that, and I think that Ms. Guy's statement actually was the best testimony regarding that issue. In Multnomah County, those are not being prosecuted, she indicated. And that's the bottom line, is that most DAs that I talk to around the state are not filing those. It is a strange animal in the law. It is not a crime, and I included the case law in here that indicates that it's not. It's this quasi-criminal civil contempt matter that cannot be added to the criminal charges we have. It cannot be part of the proceeding. They don't have a right to a jury. It's this bizarre statute on its own that has to be handled in a separate filing. It can't be added to the charges we have. When I used to be a DA in Marion County, and we did it there for several years, and when I went to Washington County 3 years ago, they had never heard of such a thing, and they had never filed those before. And I encouraged them and showed them the case law and the statutes and said there's this way that we can do it. It is rather unusual, and most counties don't do it. It is possible, but it does require a separate proceeding to handle that case that's completely separate. And what we're seeking is to have this all wrapped together. We want to have a criminal charge so that not only will it be added to their criminal history, but to their criminal record, and will accurately reflect the behavior the suspect has done to the victim. In addition to that, that it could be joined as another crime onto the charging document, and when we go forward with the case, that the case as a whole can be accurately reflected to whether it's a judge or a jury, so that they can make an honest assessment of the reliability of the particular people's testimony and the actual facts of this case as a whole. Because without that, they aren't going to understand the pressure that's being put on the victim.
Ms. Kunkel, you wish to add anything?
The only thing I would like to add, Chair and Senators, is that Ms. Guy talked about the charge of tampering with a witness, which is a felony. It is true that if we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant has caused her or compelled her or induced her to change her testimony, we can seek an indictment for that felony. But the vast majority of these cases are the victims calling me up on the phone saying, I want to drop charges. Nothing happened. I lied. I was just mad at him because I thought he was having an affair. The police lied in their report. I didn't tell them that. And so while I suspect that the reason that they are doing this is because the defendant is either asking them or threatening them to do it, rarely can I prove it beyond a reasonable doubt because she doesn't want to tell me that. And I would just point out that last week I had a voicemail from a victim begging me to get rid of the restraining order that was in effect, and I could clearly hear on the phone call him in the background telling her what to say.
And
Chair Brown, I would add to that, members of the committee, that in Washington County we have the ability to access phone calls, tapes of phone calls of suspects to victims, and basically the only time that we've been able to successfully prosecute, I mean, I have successfully prosecuted on a number of occasions tampering with the witness, but basically the only times we can do it is when we catch them on a phone call, which we do regularly, not that we're regularly able to prosecute it, but we do regularly catch them calling the victims from the jail, telling them, you know, you need to go tell the DA this, you need to tell the DA that, you better not go to court. This is what's going to happen to you if you go to court. If they actually admit and confess to all the elements in a tampering charge, which is, again, them, you know, them doing something that would cause the victim to either lie in court or to not be there, if they know that they're going to be a witness and they've been served to come to court, there's a lot of elements that we have to prove. Then, and they confess to all of that, then oftentimes, you know, we're able to prove a tampering, but it's very, very rare. They know they're being taped, and so they're very careful about the words that they use, but they make it very clear to the victims about what their role is in this proceeding, and that role is to either not to tell the entire truth about what's happened or to not come. And I would just add that even though this has been a problem for the entire, you know, 10 years that I've been in this field and the 8 years I've been prosecuting domestic violence, that right now, because of Crawford v. Washington, it has made it so that we, our backs are against the wall and trying to hold these offenders accountable, because the violence will continue regardless of what happens. We're just trying to intervene so that we can make steps to try to stop it.
Okay.
Senator Ringo.
And the case you referenced, was that the hearsay issue?
Yes. Okay. Chair Brown, Senator
Ringo. Interim Judiciary.
Yeah,
yeah,
okay.
This is...
I'm familiar with it.
Yeah, this as far as providing the defendants the right to confront all the witnesses in court.
All right. Both sides have presented extremely compelling arguments for their case. I think the winner goes to Ms. Miller, who holds the price tag. So my suggestion is Ms. Skye, Ms. Hebb, two of you and Ms. Miller meet outside. I don't know if you want to do it this evening, but sometime soon, and see if you can't address some of Ms. Skye's concerns in a way that would bring the price tag down substantially. If it were January or February, my guess is we might have an easier battle, but right now we are fiscally, we are really tight. So, and Ms. Skye raises some very good arguments. So we got a problem. Let's see if we can fix it without costing us a lot of money. So Ms. Miller, would you mind helping?
Thank you. And Chair Brown, on that issue, just very briefly, my understanding is the only price tag is on the part that makes it a felony. We obviously were anticipated that there would be some cost to that. And so if that is the only thing that's keeping this bill from going forward, then it's otherwise the language that's in it, that's something that we would be more than willing to negotiate out of there, too, in an effort to get the rest of the bill forward, because we feel it's so important.
Okay. All right. Why don't you guys see if you can work something out.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1082. Senator Westland, Mr. Mason.
Hi.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Oh,
I would just like to thank not only the Chair, but the entire committee for the very gracious treatment we received the last time I appeared before this committee.
For which I am pleasantly paying the price.
Let me help you, Madam Senator. Madam Chair, committee, Senate Bill 1082 is important to Oregon because so much of our beautiful state is forested, as we all know, thickly forested. For too long, those forests have been left to grow without the benefit of natural fire. Protecting our forest and the communities next door to them will save the beauty and livelihoods of large portions of our state that are currently at risk. Treating the thick undergrowth in Central Oregon forest is an urgent issue, one that will become a hotly, excuse the pun, Senator Shields, burning issue if not addressed very soon. The threat of summer wildfires is a terror, literally a terror, my constituents live with on a daily basis. The Warm Springs tribes are deeply committed to restoring forests to health with their biomass project based at the Warm Springs Mill. This is another effort in their partnership with other Central Oregon communities, a solution that our fuel choke forest will generate power while reducing the risk of catastrophic wildfires. Passing Senate Bill 1082 with the amendments to keep the PUC passing Senate Bill 1082 with amendments to keep PUC discretion will allow the PUC to work with a willing utility company to provide some limited assistance to this project. It's the least we can do to help the tribes, help all of us solve the forest fuel crisis. This should be an absolute no-brainer for all of us when leaders throughout rural Oregon as well as the state are urgently seeking solutions. The Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs have the management skills and the wherewithal to make this biomass project work. We just received a $250,000 Healthy Forest grant from the Forest Service and are applying to the Energy Trust for a great deal more. The committee should keep and honor the understanding that has been made regarding this bill, adopt the Dash Ones, and give the bill a due pass recommendation. When we go home, let's be able to say we contributed to the tribe's success for all of Oregon's success. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Mason?
Thank you, Vice Chair Farioli and members of the committee. I should mention that this is the testimony of, well, my name for the record, Michael Mason. I lobby for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. But this is actually the testimony of Louis Pitt, Jr., who has been held up in traffic leaving a meeting in Portland. He should be here momentarily. But I will go ahead in the interest of time and point out that I think we've had a discussion, I think, discussed with all the members of the committee the importance of Senate Bill 1082. We're very grateful for Senator Westland's work on it, as well as Senator Metzger's and others. I think the main thing to emphasize here that's not just the numbers is that when the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs gave up almost 10 million acres or turned it over to the United States in Central Oregon, that they did not give up their sense of obligation given to them by the Creator to care for the lands and the animals and plants on those lands. When they were managing the lands, there was regular fire. They initiated regular fire. There was not a problem with catastrophic wildfires because of their management. It's over a century of mistaken management, mostly by the United States, that has left us with this situation with thickly choked undergrowth forests, as well as runaway juniper on the rangelands. And if you don't know about juniper, it's got the worst of both worlds. It not only is a terrible water-sucking plant, but especially when out of place, but you can almost ignite it with a hot glance in the summer. So the project is moving forward, and I will say that the tribes will go forward with this project one way or another. They are getting ready to install their new boiler for the biomass plant. They're planning to be able to treat 10,000 or more acres a year of forest, greatly reducing fire danger in Central Oregon. They'll have a generating capacity of 30 megawatts of stable electrical power. One of the issues we have, one of the reasons we've sought this bill, is that the, you know, wind is the fad right now. Wind's very popular, and that's fine, but wind isn't a stable energy source as biomass is. So I don't really need to go through the rest of the testimony. I'd be happy to answer questions about this. We're basically asking for a little bit of help with the PUC. The great majority of this project we will fund, the tribe will fund, and you know the Energy Trust hopefully will step up, and we may not even need this, but it would help with the financing to have this little boost. So we urge your adoption of the Dash Ones and do pass recommendation for 1082. Thank you.
Senator Ringo has a question.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. First of all, thanks for coming in, and I'm happy to support the bill. I had a couple questions about the mechanics of how it works. The funding that you're seeking, is this funding to help with the work in the woods in terms of clearing the undergrowth and or transporting it to the biomass facility? And I was also wondering if you could speak to how does this pencil out financially? I mean, is it, what, do you expect this to be financially self-sustaining in the long run?
Okay, Vice Chair Farioli and Senator Ringo, the primary cost, operating cost for this project, and we estimate the operating cost is about $4.2 million a year. The primary operating cost is getting the fuels to the mill. We hope to have some serious help from the federal energy bill, which has a provision for a tax, I believe it's a tax credit, for an amount per green ton shipped for a biomass project. That will help a great deal, and if that passes in its current form, we may not need this, but we don't know that yet. As far as the total capital cost for the project, right around $31.5 million, and we'll plan to put up about 90% of that from borrowing from private lenders. I'm trying to... Sorry, it's getting a little late in the day. I'm not tracking on all of your questions.
No, well, one question. I mean, would you expect this to be self-sustaining financially?
We do.
What you would sell the power for would make up for the cost of removing the materials from the forest and transporting it and processing it. Senator Westland's nodding yes.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that in the first few years, no, we don't think that. But ultimately, yes. We just think it's a matter of years off before this is a competitive energy source. But it isn't quite yet.
Okay. And when, I believe when Mr. Mason refers to some of the help, I mean, some of the rate will have to be subsidized. It depends on, you know, what power rates are and what the mix is and what the PUC grants. And you know, that's really the most significant part of the help.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Shields.
Would it be okay if I asked if you could help me visualize what this kind of actually looks like? When you're running out in the woods, I know you're grabbing the biomass, you're hauling it in. Other than that, it looks pretty much generating plants.
You know, I'm not the most visual person, Senator, but my understanding of how the plant looks, I mean, you have a place to burn the wood, so you have a boiler, and that's generating steam, which powers a turbine. And then we sell that as we sell our other power. Warm Springs sells their other power to a subsidiary of PacifiCorp. But I don't, Mr. Pitt may have a better sense of that.
Louis Pitt, Jr., Director of Government Affairs and Planning for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. Apologies for being late. I was stuck at the Oregon Historical Society trying to find out some late information on the treaty for this weekend. Yes, it is a boiler, just a classical boiler that has fuel and hog fuel from forests and generates steam. And so we have one that's, we have two that's approximately 75, almost 80 years old now. And so we've done, I think, a very small amount of generating ourselves. And the power companies, you know, I think are always challenged when you have a small producer like this, and that's why we've kept it kind of in the mothballs and just used it to create some of our own power for our own use. Madam Chair, if I may, again, I'm not sure if Mr. Mason talked to the other side of this. There's the formal business side, but there's also the forest health side, and I think we've talked that quite a bit. And anyway, for me, I do see that that's one of the most attractive parts of this, is trying to get the east side forest health situation, get at least one more tool out there that can make its... And I think it's down the road, survive on its own, and then, again, try to defuse some of those powder kegs that we have in our forest throughout the east side.
Madam Chair.
Sarah Shields.
I realize I came late to the game, too, as you did, Julie, but this is obviously pretty labor-intensive. How many jobs can just create.
What was the estimate, Michael?
It's Senator,
Chair Brown, Senator Shields, the estimate is 60 jobs. It would be at least 60, maybe 70. And that's on reservation jobs.
A good story right there.
Yes, it is.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Westland, did you want to add something besides an amendment that I won't like?
Oh, no. You will love this amendment as all other amendments I have offered before this committee of recent days. Senate Bill 1082, we're recommending asking be amended by the dash ones.
Okay.
Same as my other amendment, Madam Chair. The
very funny.
And if it would be helpful, in the original bill, line 22, there is some concern over one mandatory provision. And if it's helpful to this committee, if it is helpful to this committee, and some of the other interested parties to this bill, I would offer that line 22, the commission shall. I think it would be acceptable to the Warm Springs if that was changed to a may.
Okay. Thank you. That's very helpful. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1082 temporarily.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
May I ask you a personal and potentially embarrassing question?
No.
Are you going to Paimshaw this weekend?
I am not.
Well, then you have to pass this bill.
Okay, Senator Wilson, that's a very good lobbying technique. Better than the happy birthdays. All right. We're going into work session on House Bill 2104. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us what the bill does, just briefly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard House Bill 2104 a couple of weeks ago, and it modifies the provisions governing the optional retirement plan set up by the state Board of Higher Education.
And we have the dash
three
amendments in front of us.
Yeah.
And we've had them for several days. Anybody just having to testify on the dash three amendments to House Bill 2104? We are in work session. The chair would move the dash three amendments to House Bill 2104. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who would like to carry? Senator Ringo, thank you for volunteering.
Volunteer.
I know, but you looked like you were going to say something, so I took it as a yes. All right.
It could have been a gas paint.
Hopefully it was. Senate Bill 499 opened a work session. Folks may remember this particular bill. It classifies telecommunications changes their status for public employees. Retirement system allows them to retire after 20 years. We have the dash five. Ms. Botkin, why don't you come on up? We have the dash. I have the dash twos and the dash fours and the dash threes. Okay. Those are the ones that we just got. Okay.
Yep.
All right.
I don't have the dash fours.
They were just passed out.
They were just passed out.
Okay.
Ms. Botkin, Mr. Delaney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We are here to encourage the committee to once again gut and stuff our bill that was introduced at our request for early retirement provisions for the 911 telecommunications operators. If you look at Senate, at the dash four amendments, you can see that this requires that a telecommunicator be employed by in that capacity for 20 years, and after 20 years they can retire regardless of age. It also provides for an actuarially reduced retirement benefit, and it also reduces the COLA burden for local governments actuarially, so that the until they reach the age of 55. And the bill is now cost neutral. And it is a huge benefit for a very limited group of folks, about 750 statewide. And it would be very well appreciated if you would accept the amendments and move the bill.
Thank you. Ms. Bodkin, I know we have the dash twos, the dash the threes. I believe the dash fours made a couple of word changes.
Yes.
Could you give those to me, please, for the record?
The dash four amendments actually made a correction to the dash two amendments.
Okay.
The dash two amendments made an actuarial. In drafting, there was a. Let me try this again. We drafted the amendments to meet the actuarially neutral cost. In drafting the amendments, legislative council inadvertently left off the words until the member attains the age of 55.
Got it. Okay.
Okay, so that's those four or five words right there.
Okay.
At the very end of the sentence are the change.
Great. Thank you. Anybody wishing to testify on those four or five words on the dash four amendments?
I brought Steve Delaney with me just in case there are any technical questions that I couldn't answer.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Chair would move the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 499. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered.
Do I need to look at Charlie?
Okay. Chair would move Senate Bill 499 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? As amended. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered.
Who would like to carry? Did you want to do it?
I do. Okay. I'll do it. I'm happy to do it. All right. Let's go down to House Bill 2070, which we heard earlier today. Ms. Harris, any amendments?
Yes. You have the dash three amendments from Senator Walker.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Brown moves the dash. We're in work session on House Bill 2070. Senator Brown moves the dash three amendments to House Bill 2070. Senator Farrioli will be recorded as a no. Senator Farrioli, for the record.
I would like to have a full complement of the committee in the room.
Got it. Can someone scream for Senator Atkinson, please?
For what purpose does he need the full
conference? Is this
a minority report?
It's possible.
and you're talking about dash three amendments?
Yes.
And why is it that we have dash amendments that go all the way to seven or something?
All right. The dash three amendments.
99?
We're in House Bill 2070. The chair has moved the dash three amendments to which Senator Farrioli objected. The dash three amendments comprise the Golden Parachute Bill, which passed on the Senate floor several weeks ago, but has had met an uphill battle in the House.
And it's a darn good bill, man.
Thank you, Senator Ringo. Any further discussion?
They may have hit an uphill battle in the House. They are going to hit a speed bump in this committee.
Yes. All right.
Only a speed bump.
All right. Okay, we'll let him. Okay, sorry. All right. Why don't you call the roll on 2070? Since I just moved the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. I already did the amendments. I didn't. I did the motion. Okay. All right. Thank you. Sarah Atkinson?
No.
Thank you.
So now we have two no's on the amendment.
Correct.
And we're on the major.
I'm moving the Senate bill to the House bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Please call the roll.
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Farrioli?
No, and Madam Chairman, I would like to serve notice of a possible minority report.
I'm shocked. Chair votes aye. Motion passes. We're going to let Senator Walker carry this little mess. And
big mess.
Madam Chair, I was in the hall. Could I vote on the 1 yard removed?
Yes.
Madam Chairman, do we need a rule suspension?
You do.
Senator
Farioli.
Suspend the rules to reconsider the vote by which we considered Senate Bill
499 as amended with the dash four amendments. Senator Farioli moves that we reconsider the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 499. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chairman, we have suspended the rules and we are in the reconsideration of the vote by which we considered Senate Bill 499. And I believe that the request is to allow Senator Atkinson to cast a vote.
That's correct.
No.
Senator Atkinson.
No. That's the motion.
I was nice.
Yes.
You're a no vote.
I'm going to be a yes on the next one, though.
We already did. No, you were no. We already did that one. All right. Senator Atkinson votes no on Senate Bill 499. Next time.
Yes.
For the record, that was my fault. I was supposed to get Senator Atkinson.
All right.
Especially.
Yes.
Senator Atkinson, we record as a no vote on Senate Bill 499, which I am carrying. Thank you very much.
Which would not
change the outcome.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right. Let's open a close the work session on Senate Bill 499. Did we get that? Okay. Open a work session on House Bill 2202.
Give me a big kitchen.
Amendments?
Yeah.
2202. All right. Chair would move House Bill 2202 as amended, the A engrossed version, to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. It is not amended. There are no new amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Senator Shields would like you to carry that bill, please.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
You're welcome very much. Okay. Chair would open a work session on House Bill 2335, which we heard earlier today. The chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. I'll carry that bill.
You guys want me to cook for the group?
Sure.
All right. Next bill up. Close public hearing. Close the work session on House Bill 2335. Open a work session on House Bill 3029. Bill, we also heard earlier there are no amendments to this bill. The chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. Who would like to carry?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much for volunteering after I requested you to do so on House Bill 3029. All right. Folks are still working on 1068. Let's open. Anything else come before the committee before we start losing our folks? Let's go back to a public hearing on Senate Bill 1082. Mr. Miller, Mr. Nelson, anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 1082?
Yes, we have another hand in the back.
Okay, come on up.
There was like a little amendment he wanted. But
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Dan Postrel, the Public Affairs Director with the Oregon Department of Forestry, here to speak very briefly indeed on Senate Bill 1082. We support the concept of this bill. Forest biomass power fits well with the Oregon business plan strategies about building on existing industrial clusters we have in the state. It supports rural economic growth in addition to benefiting forest health. And as has been pointed out here, there are serious problems with forest health in the drier forests of the east side of Oregon due to a variety of reasons, including the exclusion of fire from its natural role in those forests. This is a high matter of concern with the Oregon Board of Forestry, and we're really looking for every possible avenue to try and reduce the fuel loads and the danger of truly catastrophic fires in those forests. However, we recognize the need for in the interest of the PUC in balancing electricity rates with the need to encourage biomass and other renewable forms of energy, and we would welcome the consideration in that balancing act of the forest health considerations there. And we hope this bill leads to continued conversation about some creative ways to address both our energy needs and these serious forest health and fire danger problems that we have.
Okay.
And that's that.
All right. Mr. Miller.
Okay, for the record, my name is Greg Miller. I'm the government affairs manager for Weyerhaeuser Company. I should have my partner here, Mark Nelson.
And I've been wreaking havoc with the schedule because I went and looked for him, and then, of course, we ended up losing a member, so I had to do other stuff. So
sure.
My sincere apology.
That's all right. So I will proceed. Just to cut to the chase, we even with the Dash 1 amendments, we are opposed to the bill. We're a co-generator in this state. I would offer that if this bill were to go forward, then you ought to treat every cogenerator equally. We've had a lot of experience with this. Let me just also back up and say we are very supportive of the principles and the project that Warm Springs wants to proceed on. We think that's a right step in terms of dealing with forest biomass. We have our company has talked far and wide to policymakers in the state about how to access and how to approach this forest health issue relative to forest biomass. What we really have here is a disagreement about where this falls in terms of the PUC process relative to rates and electricity rates. And I would just say that we have been engaged with the PUC with an avoided cost proceeding that really addresses how you would cost out this kind of forest biomass project. And so we would say also that this bill is premature for that. I think you heard from the proponents of the bill that they may not even need the bill. We suggested to them that they approach the ETO, gave them information about that. I think that was helpful in the spirit of cooperation in terms of how to access additional dollars to help with their project. The Energy Trust group. And I'm not sure how much further you'd like me to talk about this. I know that there was some discussion about changing shall to may in the Dash 1s, and we still have issue with where this is headed relative to the proceedings in front of the PUC around an avoided cost order. And we believe that they are days, probably more like weeks, off of establishing what that avoided cost rate would be. We estimate that avoided cost calculation will probably cover their project. And so that's kind of our position at this stage. Mark, what I mentioned was the avoided cost proceedings that we've been engaged in both as ICNU and also as Weyerhaeuser at the table in establishing that avoided cost proceeding because, as I said before, we are cogeneration. We have two cogeneration facilities in the state. And with all due deference and respect to the tribes, if we're going to treat one class of cogenerators with this kind of treatment, then maybe all cogenerators ought to be treated in this fashion. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Sorry to wreak havoc with your schedule.
Madam Chairman,
no problem.
As I think Greg has said, we understand what the tribe is trying to do and supporting that.
We have no problem with, you know, tax credits, low interest loans, any type of package they may put together with the energy trust to make this thing work. But our fundamental problem is asking all classes of ratepayers to pay for a project that may not be economical. It's that simple. And we, if we had come to the legislature, as Mr. Miller has said, and asked for those same kinds of considerations for other projects out there that might not be economically viable today, but we want all classes of ratepayers to support those projects, I believe we would be turned down. And again, I don't want to denigrate the proposal that is here and what they're trying to do. And as we testified in Senate business on the same bill, we support that effort. We support the effort before the Energy Trust, which at that point they hadn't applied. My understanding is today that not they applied today, but they have approached the Energy Trust. We will support that. But it's just fundamentally against the PUC process for ratepayers to be supporting a project that is not economically feasible. We're not saying it won't be, but the way this bill is set up, and even with if we change the shell to May, we still have a fundamental problem with dealing with it in this manner. I'm sorry, I didn't say I represented the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. Okay.
So, Mr. Nelson, your testimony is that both on lines 18 and 22, if we lean delete shells and move those to May, that you will still be in opposition to the bill.
Are you still? Or, I'm sorry. Are you still on the pin 82 and not the dash ones?
I was looking at the underlying bill, but the amendments also have shells as well.
Madam Chair, help out the other side, I think they would move the shell in line 18.
Okay.
That becomes a May, but it's still
in line
still
10.
Says the, yeah, in line 10 of the amendments, it still says the commission shall allow the recovery of those costs from all classes of ratepayers.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just to make a statement about this amendment and the bill, I would support the shell to make changes in both the amendment and the bill, which I think indicates that I would support the underlying bill as well. I think I've made that position clear to the opponents that are here today. Just want to point out two things for the record. We make extensive use of wind power in Oregon, and if that stuff was required to pencil out, we wouldn't be building it. If it wasn't for the tax credits that come with the alternative energy issues, those projects are not viable. When I look at pond cost for juniper conversions, they don't pencil out either. As a matter of fact, I didn't learn that until I felled 300 acres of juniper in eastern Oregon. And a standing juniper is worthless to the commercial market because the logging and transportation costs make it unviable, even as a fuel. So virtually all of our juniper removal projects are subsidized through the U.S. Forest Service, the Oregon Department of Forestry, or the APHIS program, the American Field Services Farm Services program. So juniper removal in and of itself is a really good objective because it is so water intensive. Just converting juniper into carbon loading in the atmosphere is a bad idea, and that's what usually happens. The juniper just gets burnt, and it piled as brush piles and burned up. If you can convert it into energy, admittedly, it does transfer the cost of that to ratepayers, and the industrial ratepayers, being the largest users in many cases, are going to get the most cost. But I also have to balance this issue about against a 40 to 50% unemployment factor on the Warm Springs reservations, which I represent. So when I look at the whole picture, the issue of removing the carbon load, removing the juniper, and creating the jobs, I can stand the hit on the rates. And I may hear from the co-ops and others that don't think that's a good idea. But and I certainly have heard from the industrial ratepayers. But all things being equal, I think this is a wise investment of public resources and private resources.
Mr. Nelson, I think what I'm struggling with is that my recollection is the last time this was on the Senate floor, it was in another bill, I believe Senate Bill 408. And I guess I thought folks had kind of worked out an agreement or at least a neutral position on it with some language. My understanding then was that 408 was used to deal with some other issues, and that the commitment was made to bring this bill back in a standalone version. Is that incorrect? And I actually think I had the conversations with Mr. Linden and not with you, so I'm...
Madam Chair, I can't speak for Mr. Linden, but at this point, I don't think that was correct. I have a memo here which was written by Kincannon at the time that it was coming back, and in this form, which had the 0.3%. And I always knew it was going to come back, and that was my understanding, was some other version, but we never agreed to any language. We did have discussions about changing everything to May, or some of them to May. And we indicated at that point that I think there were still two Mays in the latest reiteration, or what it was going to be at that point, that we still objected. Just to say that the 0.3% is $3 to $5 million a year for 5 years. That's our estimate, which we feel is significant. We've been in rate cases for a lot less before the PUC. So,
okay. And your issue about tribal sovereignty... in terms of giving the tribes special deference, your argument would be one of you?
There should be no special deference, and with all great regard to their sovereignty, we just don't believe that the ratepayers of this state should be paying for a project that's not economically feasible.
Okay. All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on this bill? I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm not going to move into work session. Maybe you guys have worked the bill to the extent possible, but I'd like to give you 23 hours or 22 hours or something to try and get something worked out. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing. Any other business to come before the committee? With that, we're adjourned. Why don't you guys come on?